Monday, January 21st. It is Martin Luther King Day.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to LA Podcast. I'm Scott Frazier. We've got Hayes Davenport here.
Yes, it's boys night in LA Podcast Studio. No Alyssa tonight. Vintage LA Podcast, just Hayes and Scott. Alyssa, she said that we could make up whatever excuse we wanted for her not being here tonight, but I'll just tell the truth, which is she has really gotten into the Irvine street racing scene. She comes on the show and she like talks like very negatively about cars and stuff, but right. she has like an Impala that she has like really
just like it's like speed.
Murdered out.
Yeah.
And this isn't like drag racing. This is on like surface streets, yeah. Like not like in residential areas.
You know, on particularly quiet nights, if you turn off your kitchen appliances and things, you might hear her zoom by.
Yes. And of course, it's a super wolf blood moon tonight, which means it's like the biggest race of the year. And so that's where she is. I think she is like anti-car, so she can have more for herself.
Okay.
She wants people to not drive. And also, so the roads will be clearer for her to hit at like 200 miles an hour.
That's weird, because I always thought part of the thrill for her was actually dodging other people, you know, that are basically standing still. Right,
pedestrians and yeah, baby carriages. You have an LA story. We got a lot of news. Another packed week. Do you have any LA stories from this week?
It was raining. It was
rained all week.
Did we have like what was that considered an atmospheric river? It was kind of interesting to me. I actually was looking at NOAA's, which somehow NOAA's website is still getting updated, even though the government is apparently never going to receive funding again.
This is the NOAA. That's
right. Actually don't know what it stands for.
National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, maybe?
That sounds... I would go with that. I was looking at them.
It was still updating. I was checking it. Any website where the numbers are changing is like a little game and just gives you something to do on your phone all day.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was really obsessed with like the numbers getting up. And do you know about... do you ever check LA Almanac?
Yeah.
LAAlmanac.com has great rain updates and they cross check with like what the normal average is. So you're trying to get to like a goal.
Yeah. Gamifying. The weather.
It's one of the funnest games you can play watching this website.
I was looking at the drought monitor site on NOAA, which was kind of cool because you could actually see looking at the difference between, I think that their weekly cycle updates on Tuesdays or something, and it posts on Thursday. So on Thursday, I actually looked at it and it was like in 1 week, basically the entire state of California dropped from being in moderate drought to like minimal drought conditions.
Yeah.
And that was not including Wednesday or Thursday, which I think were even heavier.
Yeah, Thursday was big.
So in 1 week, I mean, that is pretty significant.
And it wasn't even that big. January of 2 years ago, we got 8 or 9 inches.
Yeah.
And this month it's going to be like 5, which is above average.
Right.
It's like almost 2 inches above average, but it's not like crazy.
Yes.
So, I mean, it just shows you what it takes to like get into drought. It's like really serious when we're in drought territory if all it takes is like a decent rain to get us out of it.
They were saying that, and I actually haven't checked that this is the case, but I know before the storms actually hit last week, they were saying that they expected, I think this was in the LA Times, they were saying they expected in that 72-hour period from Tuesday to Thursday that we were going to get as much rain as we did in the entire rainy season last year. So that's how we end up back in drought conditions.
Yeah.
It only takes 1 year of that to...
I think we got more this month for sure, because last year it was like 4.5 inches or something like that, the entire season. And this month we got like 5.
So it was, I was, you know, my LA story is I was doing normal LA things. I was frantically trying to figure out what in my wardrobe was somewhat impermeable to the rain.
There are like certain jackets where you're like, this should be waterproof, but is it?
Yeah, Tuesday was no good because I took out my one sweatshirt that that has a hood. I'm wearing it again right now. Yep. It was completely soaked by the time I got to my office.
It's not for water. I mean, it's the kind of hoodie that like gains like 10 pounds of weight if it gets wet.
It's not for water at all. It was completely soaked by the time I got in. The next day I had to struggle to figure out how to use an umbrella, which was just like, I don't know, Laurel and Hardy-esque slapstick as my umbrella is blowing inside out on Olive downtown. And I just couldn't seem to figure out how to make all of the parts of my rain attire work together. So it was a very wet week for me.
Yeah. But not going to mention his wife's birthday and his LA story.
It's my wife's birthday today. We went downtown. We went to Long Beach Flea Market.
That's
which
way
is,
downtown.
We did kind of a boomerang action. We went to Long Beach and then we came back and went downtown to Clayton's, which was fun. It was a nice, relaxing way to spend the weekend. She has tomorrow off. I will be working. So
you don't have tomorrow off.
No.
Do better.
Okay.
Scott's job and Scott, I guess.
I thought that was directed squarely at me.
No, I was talking to your boss, but I guess it was your decision for everyone to come into work if you're taking the blame. I have an LA story that is like sort of connected to something that was in the news and was truly horrible. I wish Alyssa were here for this because she spoke up a lot about it this week on Twitter. On Hyperion in Silver Lake, there was a lot of rain this week. With rain in LA comes car crashes. People don't take care of their cars for rain. Everyone's tires are like completely bald. We don't know how to drive in it. All of these different factors. And there was a fatal crash on Hyperion on Wednesday morning where a car was going too fast down Hyperion and fishtailed out of control and hit a woman and killed her, who was on the side, walking down the sidewalk, wasn't crossing the street. She was right on the sidewalk, right by King Middle School on Hyperion. Her name was Christina Garcia. She was 57. She took that walk every morning for 15 years. She along the way would collect cans that she would cash in to contribute to her daughter's college fund. And that's what she was out doing. I live fairly close to there, but not like super, super mm-hmm. close. And even so, I didn't put this together until days later, but I heard it. I heard like a really, really long tire screech.
Oh my God.
Which I didn't even really register at the time because you do hear that on that street all the time. It's one of those streets that allows you to go super, super fast at certain times of day until someone comes out of a driveway or like a light changes and you have to like stop really short. It's really dangerous. There have been accidents like in that area many, many times. And the thing that really disturbed me about it, let me pull up the exact quote. So it was a hit and run. The driver got out and examined his vehicle, but they said it was unclear if he knew that he had
hit a person
because he just looked at his vehicle. There was an LAPD spokesman who was talking about what happened, and he said, this is a straight accident. All that person had to do was stop and call the police.
Yep.
And so now that someone is dead, this is a felony hit and run. And what that means, I mean, it's not even like a subtle, unspoken thing. It's saying if he had driven so dangerously to hit this person and kill them on the sidewalk, to go up on the sidewalk and kill someone, it would not have been an issue at all.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we saw with, we talked about Woon Fraser, in one of our early episodes last year, cyclist who was killed by a woman in an SUV that just fully overran him and, crushed him on his bike. She turned herself in and has seen no criminal repercussions whatsoever. It's not There's no like code at this point. It's just understood. If you kill someone with your car, you odds will get away with it.
There will be no repercussions
if you're caught in the first place, which odds are you will not be.
Yeah. I mean, this is not to get too far from the incident at hand, but it's really disturbing that this is the messaging that comes from law enforcement. I think it's been this way in LA and a lot of cities in America, but in LA for a very long time, probably going back to the aftermath of World War II, going back to the 40s, the police have been saying, if something happens to you, if you're injured as a pedestrian by a car, it's your fault. We were just talking about the LAPD saying that the problem or like one of the solutions to the issue of pedestrians getting injured is to introduce defensive walking and give pedestrians fluorescent jackets that they can wear so that cars can see them. Police are very much still today at the vanguard of putting the blame for whatever happens to pedestrians squarely on the pedestrians, exculpating drivers, even in situations like with Wound Fraser, where it seems like there was deliberate malicious intent after the fact. And how does that change? Because that the thing is, like, there are codes about, like, you know, you're not allowed to just murder people.
It's vehicular manslaughter. If you operate your vehicle irresponsibly and it leads to someone being killed, that's all it takes to be convicted of that crime. But I think there's an "it could happen to any of us" attitude. You know, it's like, well, if this person goes to jail for this, what if I am driving irresponsibly and I kill someone? Then I have to go to jail. And there is, I even had a feeling where the woman, when the woman who hit Wound Fraser, that was a hit and run. But when she turned herself in, you just have this pang of like, God, this, I mean, we try not to use the word accident now because there is like a level of culpability involved. But she did not do this on purpose. And I had this feeling of like, God, now her life is totally ruined over this. But that did not turn out to be true. And whose life is ruined is, well, of course, Wound Fraser, who is
and
dead.
And his family and his community.
And his mother and his child.
Yeah.
And basically everyone who knew him.
Which is always just, it's amazing to me too, because I think that as we've started in LA talking about like reforming the criminal justice system here, and in California had like Prop 47, led to a lot of small time criminal offenders being let out of jails early. And the response from law enforcement officers was, well, now we're totally demoralized, and like, if why would we even like give somebody arrest somebody for having drugs or whatever if they're not going to go to prison? But now we're talking about people actually killing other people.
Yes, and they don't want to put them in jail.
And there's no urgency at all.
I'm shocked that we haven't talked about this before, because this drives me insane. And this is something that the local media, including the Times, is responsible for as well. When the Prop 47 stuff, when property theft went up this year, like petty crimes and stuff, and the LAPD put out their reports saying that these kind of crimes had gone up, and they pinned it, they blamed it on Prop 47.
Yeah.
And the LA Times ran these reports and just sort of unquestioningly made the connection to Prop 47. More the former prisoners are out of jail, so these people must be committing crimes again.
Yeah.
Then later this past year, when murder rates went down and violent crimes went down, the LAPD put out that report, and they said it was because of better policing.
Yeah.
That's the reason that, you know, nothing about how that's going down all over the country in every city in America. They said, no, the LAPD is handling crimes better. And the fact that the murder rate and the violent crime went down was because of because we did a good job.
Yeah.
So it never goes up because they did a bad job. It went up because they let too many people out of jail or whatever.
Yeah.
It went down because they did a good job. And the LA Times reports this.
Like it is fact, and not like it is blatant political manipulation.
The connection
of
what we're talking about is fatal crashes have gone up. Yep. More people are dying on the street. And I have never seen the connection made that this has anything to do with how these crimes are policed. I don't know if it does, but the LAPD is certainly not taking responsibility. CHP is not taking responsibility for these deaths.
And I would say that they are not doing a good job policing.
No, they're not. I mean, I don't know if it's because of that, but right. I know they're not doing a good job.
Exactly.
Because even when they have the person in custody, they do not punish them. Okay, let's move on. That was a long LA story. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
We got a strike. Strike is still going.
Yep.
Boy, I can't tell you what a great... So this week, my wife asked me to stay inside. I am recovering from pneumonia from last week, and she said I was not allowed to go out in the rain and protest with people. So that makes me a hypocrite. That's okay. I was not allowed to. But boy, do I love... honking. I have like,
oh my God, yeah.
My favorite honks, anywhere. If I'm passing the protest in the car, it's like the funnest thing in the world. You like hold your fist in the air and do the whole thing. It's a blast. Where are we? It's been a week.
Yep. 5 days of striking so far.
I think, a guy I follow on Twitter, Hunter Owens, who works with the city in some capacity, put out a poll asking people what would end first, the strike or the shutdown. What do you think?
The strike.
That's what most people said.
Not you? You don't think so?
I think that they are on a much... it's likelier to end sooner because they are like on the path to ending it more quickly, but it also feels like the shutdown could just end in a second with like no warning.
Right.
You know what I mean? Without like long negotiations, because it's so stupid and just like inherently unpredictable. So I think it's a not an easy question, but I agree with you at this point. Now that they're negotiating, now that the mayor has gotten involved, it seems like the strike is going to end first.
I would have said that even earlier before the negotiations started, just because I feel like the intransigence at the federal level is going to take something remarkable to break. And I think that that might happen before too long, but I do think that the strike will finish sooner than that. So here we are. It is Monday. It's a holiday. Very likely when you're listening to this, the union, UTLA, and LAUSD will be still in mediated discussions. Mm-hmm. Mediated by Mayor Eric Garcetti. I have to walk back a considerable amount of my snark because here's Garcetti. He is overseeing the talks just like he offered to do several weeks ago. We talked about the fact that the mayor's office had reached out and the union had basically just ignored their offer. And maybe we're just holding it in their back pocket for the completion of the first week of the strike when... now they have
more leverage.
They've cost the school district
a lot of money. I was shocked at how much they lose because kids are not going to school and they really are not. Something like 50,000 kids went, I think, on average last week. And in LAUSD is
500,000. So let's talk about this. So the strike itself, over the past week, there have been picket lines at a number of schools in the morning and the evening. There have been a number of separate actions, some at City Hall. It was raining all week. Mm-hmm. This was something that we talked about. Like the teachers need to be out there on the picket line. They need to keep moving. They need to do all of this stuff in order to keep the strike action going. This was basically going up against the inclement weather that we had.
And they really showed up.
Yeah, they did.
They were really out there.
And a lot of people showed up to join the picket line with them.
Yeah.
I actually went and volunteered to basically like babysitting at a community meeting on Wednesday.
Oh, cool.
That could have been my LA story.
Yeah.
So a lot of people in the community actually showed up with to show their support for the teachers. This could have been a very, very difficult mental hurdle for the teachers to overcome. They're coming out and they're striking in very cold, very hard weather to be out in every single day at 7 a.m. And they did it with such grace and aplomb that, I mean, even by the end of the week, I feel like major news outlets were like, man, these teachers are really just like soaking in all of the support that the city has to give them right now.
So I'm amazed by it. We talked when we had the teachers on the show that teachers unions have taken a hit in the culture, even in like liberal progressive culture over the last few years by Waiting for Superman and yep. like certain pieces of media that emphasize that it's hard to fire teachers yeah. and they're in, like they have, make too much pension money or whatever. I cannot believe how quickly that has turned around. I think it started with the Red Fred protests around the country, but LA is fully behind these teachers and all the reporting I've seen. They talk about people going into schools and talking to parents who have to take care of their kids all week and stuff like that. And it seems like pretty much everyone is universally behind the teachers, with the exception of the district employee who yelled "build the wall" at them from her car, right. because then none of you people would be here, right. she said, and a few other outliers. But for the most part, I've just been totally blown away by how positive the reaction has been. I admit, when Garcetti first got involved, I did sort of a default snark about it because it seemed like he was just offering them basically a venue. Just like to like a room to have these negotiations, and he wasn't there for a lot of it,
right?
Which is fine. Like he has other mayor stuff to do. That's okay. But I thought the idea of him like brokering the discussion was a little bit overblown. But then LA Taco pointed out something that like seems to have made a big difference, which is during the early negotiations, both sides were leaking like crazy.
Yeah.
They're not even leaking. They would have press conferences where they would be like, this is what was offered to us. This is a disgrace. Yep. We're not even close. And just like embarrassing each other back and forth in yeah. public.
I do agree that that seems like it has changed, and that's a good sign.
It seems fully shut down. Yep. They've done press conferences and stuff, but just to say, like, we're continuing to talk. I have not heard really anything in one direction or the other about how those talks have been going, which, yes, is a good sign in terms of getting the strike ended.
I think that that is, to me, that is where I would, at this point, we'll see what comes out in the eventual deal when the strike is concluded.
Yeah.
But to me, at this point, that does seem like it is the strongest thing that you can say about Garcetti's leadership. Personally, the mayor's office, their leadership in mediation so far, is that you can say that very clearly, a lot of the back and forth sniping has been shut down. You have to imagine that to some degree that is a result of the influence of the mayor's office acting as a not a go-between, but really balancing out the two sides right now. So whatever deal there is remains to be seen. It is entirely possible that it could that we could end this long weekend with a completed mm-hmm. deal agreed upon by both sides, and that school will be back in session on Tuesday.
Is that a prediction?
I would say that is my prediction.
Back in session on Tuesday.
I would think so. I think that there is a considerable amount of desire to get it done on both sides there. But yeah, I think that the school district has definitely been feeling the pain of the lost revenue from students not attending. Teachers have made a very strong case that there is no instruction going on there.
Yeah.
The school district sent out some troubling robocalls, basically saying that students could end up in legal jeopardy if they didn't attend. And yet that does not seem to be swaying that many people, and
right.
most of the students are not attending.
The only thing I'm pessimistic about is LAUSD's social media activity. Has been anytime there's like an anti-teacher editorial anywhere in the country, it goes straight on
onto their feed.
LAUSD feed. Not anti-teacher, but yes, anti-teacher, and like the strike is hurting kids and like it's not going to fix anything and that kind of thing.
You found something on the from an elementary school.
Oh, so
right?
funny. Well, because LAUSD retweeted it, and right. it was an elementary school being like the kids are got a lesson in like visual messaging and stuff like that, like showing like we're still teaching the kids lessons, even without teachers. But the kids were
to come back.
But not even like someone pointed out correctly what they were doing, which was shaming the teachers into coming back because they were teaching to like paint murals saying like "Welcome back, teachers," being like, "Isn't this pathetic that the kids have to be without teachers for a week because of your greed or whatever?" I am encouraged that LAUSD Austin Buettner's messaging now is correct and sending it to, obviously they're not going to take the blame themselves, but he's saying we need more money from the state, which is true. At some point there, the state is going to have to get involved in this. I've seen a lot of state representatives wearing red this week to support the teachers. How they can really support them is changing policy to get more money potentially from property taxes, which we don't pay in California, at least not as high as we should, and putting them into schools. Let's talk about congestion pricing. Boy, I'm sorry Alyssa isn't here because this would get her really excited.
Yep.
But there were a few big announcements, especially one big announcement this week. Phil Washington, the CEO of Metro, is bringing the heat. I cannot believe.
I am completely shocked.
How? I mean, it's almost like he had like a near-death experience or something. It feels like Office Space. Right. Like, where does he had like an epiphany and he's like, just fuck it. I'm just going for it.
And he's gonna, at the end of the week, he's gonna be at the construction site just pounding away with a hammer.
Yes.
He's not gonna be the CEO anymore.
He's pushing congestion pricing really hard, and the quote that I saw all over the place this week is he said, "We're talking about saving mankind here. Yeah. This is no small thing." And that is not an overstatement at all. He's absolutely right.
He's absolutely correct. And it's just, it's so staggering. I think people always say to me, I've written a lot of stuff about Metro. And the thing that people always come back and say to me when I write something that's critical about Metro is like, God, it seems like this is a transit agency that has no self-respect whatsoever.
That is just like, you don't really want to do this, do you? Yeah.
And it is completely, for understandable reasons, non-committal about the things that are most necessary in order to improve the actual, what it looks like to take transit in LA. And to be fair, some of that is out of their control to a certain extent. You have a board of directors that is composed of politicians, and then you have the more technocratic staff who are actually people who care about transit quality. Metro doesn't have control over the roads. All of that control is given over to the cities that the roads go through. Metro has control over how often it runs buses and where it builds rail and stuff like that, but it doesn't actually have the ability to, say, independently put down a bus lane or independently put up a bus shelter.
Yep.
So a lot of things that are terrible about riding transit in LA are actually directly attributable to the cities.
Yes.
This is an area where Metro can independently start implementing price controls on car congestion.
Because when you say that they don't control the roads, they do control the highways.
They do control the highways.
Yes.
And they do have, I believe that they do have the ability to, as the regional transportation commission, they actually have the ability to broadly implement these kind of price controls, or they would if the state legalizes it.
Yes.
So,
and we should just explain for people that haven't heard us talk about this before. Congestion pricing just means that you charge tolls for people to drive into the city on the highways during peak hour. If they were to do this, it would be during peak hours.
Right. Absolutely. This is something that Metro should be doing. They haven't done it up until now because LA is a city and a region where almost everybody drives. Almost everybody drives alone.
Yes.
Almost everywhere.
Yes.
So there has been a lot of pressure for transit to be improved without materially making the experience of driving a car in LA worse.
Yes.
Everything that we do is about making driving easier. So I think that this is a remarkable moment when we actually have our transit agency saying that they're willing to take on the combined forces of millions and millions of drivers in LA who are going to completely go batshit insane.
Yes. And there's nothing but precedent for drivers going insane at the slightest inconvenience.
Oh, yeah.
Including, as we've talked about, council member Mike Bonin in Council District 11 getting a recall campaign thrown at him for like basically putting some cones up on a street in Playa del Rey.
Yep.
Like a road diet to like cut a lane off.
Yeah, so it's a remarkable thing. I think that what is so encouraging to me is not just that they're doing this, but I think that the messaging is exactly right. We talked about when we were doing our rundown of the ballot measures last fall that I was really unhappy with the way that the anti-gas tax repeal, the No on 6 group, they were not mentioning anything about climate change. It was all about, this is what we're going to do with this money. We're going
infrastructure
to
infrastructure
like
projects,
fix bridges,
jobs, yeah,
fix potholes, et cetera.
Yes.
Relatively boring stuff that is aimed at, I mean, it's important, but it's relatively boring stuff that's aimed at drivers and is rooted in this kind of status quo mentality about how people get around. I think that Phil Washington coming out and saying transitioning people out of cars is something that we need to do and is related to the existential threat that climate change represents. So that is very cool. He's talked in the past, in the past couple of weeks about using the proceeds for that to fully subsidize transit fares, make transit free in LA for everybody. And that is really forward thinking. That is incredible. And I'm happy to see that we're actually talking about that.
Yes.
Just kind of stunned.
And I owe it to you and Alyssa to like to get as excited as I did about that this week is because of like your enthusiasm for it and the convincing me that it is absolutely the right and urgent thing to do. We do have some updates this week from the burgeoning scandal at a city hall. Not quite as big a fallout as we maybe expected. I'm not sure if it really deserves using the song this week. Just kidding. Weezer! Hey, it ain't so.
Del Price is a flight taker.
You didn't sing it.
I'm sorry.
You don't have to. So that was one of our predictions that was wrong. After Jose Huizar was included in a, or centrally included in a document that was found by a Twitter user named Seamus Hughes, an FBI warrant involving his possible participation in extortion and money laundering and bribery and many other financial crimes using his position of power in City Hall to extract money from developers. Councilmember Curran Price was included in those documents as well in a nonspecific way. But
did have to deal with flights to China.
Yes.
And did mention his wife, Del,
yes,
prominently. CD9 was in there, flights to China and Del.
So Del Price is a flight taker.
Not necessarily a good sign.
No. So we predicted that Huizar was not going to show up at city council on Monday after we recorded that episode because he had taken a few days off after the FBI originally raided his office. He did show up. He was there all week. Curran Price did not show up on Tuesday. There was a little more just kind of revealing of what the different crimes were that these guys were allegedly involved in. In particular, there was a former aide of Huizar's, Georgia Sparza, who now works for Wendy Carrillo, who is sort of a rival to Huizar, at least in terms of how she seems to be hiring every person who then later goes on to sue or speak out against Huizar. Anyway, Georgia Sparza was mentioned in these documents, in the warrant, and he strongly implied that he provided incriminating evidence against Huizar. He said that he took steps to protect himself.
Yeah. I think that this is a remarkable quote. I want to read it in its entirety. This is from the article that Emily Alpert Reyes and David Zonizer, who cover the City Hall beat and have been all over this story. This quote, which Esparza emailed to them, is just really something astonishing to me at this point in the investigation. Esparza said, "As Huizar's special assistant, I was in one of the best positions to see how the council member wielded his political power in ways which, while he apparently had normalized, I did not feel aligned with how I wanted to live my political and personal life. So I got out before I became collateral damage, and I took steps to protect myself. Now I work for someone who does it the right way." And I took steps to protect myself, as you said, Hayes. Yeah. That is really a... that is quite a line to drop at this point in time.
I will say it seems like he may not have gotten out before he became collateral damage, because as we mentioned, he was listed in this warrant as a person of interest.
Yep.
And also in one of the articles about from earlier this year, the pre-scandal about Huizar funneling his aides to work on his wife's campaign and things like that, he was quoted in one of those articles suggesting that, yes, they had worked on the wife's campaign a little bit, but it, like, she was such a big part of the, you know, something like that. But he also said, like, I wish them the best. I wish the Huizars no harm.
Yeah, I think that there are two ways to read this. And one is that he is George Esparza, that is really underestimating the extent to which he appears to be implicated in all of this and is hoping
he's correctly estimating it.
It is hoping that he can rhetorically distance himself from some of it. The other alternative that seems likely to me is that he has been fully cooperating for some length of time with the FBI investigation.
May have been the initial whistleblower.
That remains to be seen. We talked about last week the fact that Esparza, his email address was listed as the FBI was looking into his email address in a search warrant in 2017. Mm-hmm. In February 2017, he didn't leave the council member's office and employment until December of that year. So if he was the whistleblower, we don't know whether or not the FBI contacted him and said that he was implicated in a number of shady dealings and should then report on Huizar's activity to them, or if he actually initiated that contact himself, if in fact that did happen. But that is quite a statement by Esparza. So that's something that we'll be watching closely going forward.
Interesting wrinkle in the Huizar story, something I had totally forgotten if I ever knew it. Twitter user Milzy Pop pointed this out. Huizar, this is not the first time that he has been under federal investigation. When he was on the LA Board of Education, there was an FBI investigation against him looking into whether a labor nonprofit paid him like $30,000 in like 2003, 2004. And the other person involved in that scandal was a guy named Miguel Contreras, who was a huge labor leader at the time and husband of now State Senator Maria Elena Durazo. Until he died in 2005.
Yep. Right.
And that sort of ended that case. So kind of, this isn't his first rodeo, essentially, but he got out of it. I don't think it's going to be quite as easy this time.
And the last update that we have from this week is that we have an anonymous tipster who was... really hitting the pavement, the digital pavement on Facebook, and managed to find even more information about the mysterious Ricky Zhang.
The mysterious Ricky Zhang. So we talked about a few people in the warrant, a few names in the warrant that we couldn't really get to the bottom of. And one was Yan Yan, who we thought might be a high level like Blackstone Asia employee. Or could be a city clerk.
Right.
That was your observation. And the mysterious Ricky Zhang, a name that we couldn't figure out who it was at all.
Who Emily Alpert Reyes and David Zonizer did find in state election filings, Ricky Zhang, as somebody related to Shinzen Hazens, I believe.
Yes.
So we then later in the week got a message that somebody had found Ricky Zhang's Facebook profile.
Yes, profile photo next to a private jet. So already you're like, okay, this is the dude.
A lot of photos from Las Vegas.
Yes.
He is frequently at the the Ho Chi Cafe.
Tagged himself at the Ho Chi Cafe
in San Gabriel,
which is mentioned in the
search warrant.
In the search warrant, as a place where a lot of like illicit meetings took place.
Maybe don't tag yourself at the yes. place where you are potentially doing crimes.
And he also has a picture where it really seems like he's doing a cunnilingus gesture. I just think that's worth pointing out. And this anonymous tipster also found a Facebook account for Yan Yan.
They're friends.
They are friends.
They're friends.
And Yan Yan appeared. You were right, Scott. It is the city clerk who then went on to work for the Universal Sheridan,
which is also named in
which
the
is one of the buildings
search warrants.
And yes, mentioned in the search warrant. It's all. I mean, it was all on Facebook. The whole time, they just put it all up there.
Nobody else, as far as we can tell, nobody else named in the search warrant is unfortunate enough to be friends, Facebook friends, with Ricky Zhang at this point in time. But we'll continue to monitor that as well.
Someone who's emerging as like kind of a hero in all this is Councilmember David Rue in CD4, who has campaigned for a while to get development money out of campaigns, out of politics, basically. He did not get any in his original. He didn't get any campaign money in his original run in 2015. I think partially because he was running as a kind of outsider, he was mm-hmm. not going to get it. Instead of Carolyn Ramsey, who he was running against, who was the aide to Tom LaBonge, the preceding council member. But he has been making this push for a while. I don't know how much of the problem that would solve, considering what we're talking about is like envelopes, like slipped, mm-hmm. you know, like illicitly, you know, like through mail slots. Like, it's not like this is not money that's on the books.
Right.
And if anything, I mean, I don't know if it would make it worse, but I don't think it addresses the problem of illegal payments.
Right.
Which is what we're talking about here. But any anti-developer sentiment right now is going to get you points.
It definitely is.
Because the brand is not strong. We should talk about some turnover on the council too. Mitch Englander, as we talked about, might be the case, was replaced by former council member Greg Smith. Did you watch the council meeting where that happened?
Yeah, I was watching because I was trying to see whether or not Huizar or Curran Price were going to be there.
Yeah, this is the one where Price was not there.
Price was absent.
Yes.
So I was just basically, I happened to tune in at the point in time that they were talking about this with Greg Smith.
Yeah.
And it was...
we've talked about him before. This is the former council member who was like a reserve officer and would wander around his district carrying a gun and arresting criminals.
L.A.'s Bosch, yes. I think is what we decided on. Basically, the story here is that there was very little discussion, as usual, as is quite common on city council. They unanimously approved Greg Smith. He then subsequently took his seat on the dais, and
that is unbelievable to me. It's like the movie Eddie, where Whoopi Goldberg is just sitting in the stands, and all of a sudden she wins a contest, and now she's the coach she's of the Knicks, and she comes out of the crowd, and now she just like sits in her new seat, and that's what happened with Greg Smith. One second he's just an onlooker, and now he just comes up and sits in the seat in that same meeting.
In that same meeting, he participated in the vote.
The next vote
I believe it was the next vote, and there was a lot of, the little discussion that did take place was mostly Greg Smith speaking on his own behalf and saying that he was very laudatory of the other council members of
appointing him,
of the manner in which they appointed him, and the fact that they weren't just letting, you know, 500,000 Angelenos have no representation on the council.
I mean, if that's the alternative, I guess, sure.
Which I guess is
and that was the precedent when Felipe Fuentes disappeared in the middle of his term a few years ago. They let District 7 just go unrepresented for like a year and a half, I think. Yep. So if it's between undemocratically choosing a guy you know to manage this district and nobody and doing nobody. It, I guess ideally there would be an election.
And there is going to be a CD12 special election, which Greg Smith has already said that he is not going to participate in, mm-hmm. whether or not that remains the case. Yeah. Of course, who knows? There's nothing really holding him to that. But
we know, I mean, he's doesn't have a ton to do. He's solving cold cases. He's going to the like police department and saying like, what do you have to keep me busy today?
So Greg Smith, LA's temporary 15th council member.
When is the special going to be?
I don't think that they've set the date yet. I can check, though.
But it's got to be pretty soon because it has to be before 2020 when the actual election is.
The special election for CD12 is actually going to be in July of this year. So it will be pretty soon.
Wow.
Yeah.
And a few candidates have emerged, but I don't think we've looked into them enough yet to really even mention any of their names. Sheriff's Department, back in the news. There was a honeymoon period for Alex Villanueva where all he had done is fire every senior.
A bunch of people.
Yeah, just fire. But who he said he was going to fire. So that was fairly expected. But now there's a controversy when it comes to his hiring practices.
Yeah. So unfortunately, we are back in 2019 with our sheriff's department and one.
Yes.
The segment that we wish we could discontinue, but remains as relevant as ever.
We are not allowed.
We're actually only picking two of the three scandals this week. So, basically the biggest news of this week from the Sheriff's Department is that Villanueva is reinstating a former deputy, Deputy Mandoyan, who was part of his campaign and was part of his swearing-in ceremony, who was driving him around from one campaign event to another.
He also, notably, there was another candidate in the race named Bob Lindsay, and according to Maya Lau's reporting with the LA Times, Deputy Mandoyan helped get support for Villanueva from Lindsay people, just sort of uniting those factions, which was really important when it came to eventually defeating Sheriff McDonald.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that in a second once we discuss who Deputy Mandoyan is. So this is clearly somebody that Villanueva was close to, without a doubt, throughout the course of the campaign season. Now he is reinstating him, but the reason why he is a former deputy is because he was accused by somebody that he says was an ex-girlfriend. I don't believe that she characterized it that way. He was accused by a woman of stalking and violent assault and threats and basically a ton of behavior that would seem to be disqualifying in a law enforcement officer. Certainly the former sheriff administration thought so, and they had removed him from the force. Now, Villanueva is coming in and he's putting him back in, badge in hand, gun in hand, and he is going to be back on the streets. And Villanueva's explanation for why he is doing this is somewhat in line with what he said during the course of the campaign, which is basically that he thinks that a lot of the processes that are in place assume guilt on the part of the deputies, and he does not believe that that is credible.
I mean, he wasn't that candid about it. He chalked it all up to protocol. I tweeted out the statement this week, which I mean, I thought was completely disgusting because it doesn't mention any of the allegations against the deputy, or even the fact that we're talking about a guy that was accused of choking his ex-girlfriend, breaking into her house. And I think, I mean, none of this is acceptable, but in a way it's even worse that the person who accused him of doing this was another deputy of the sheriff's department.
Right.
Someone else who the sheriff is supposed to be representing and overseeing.
Yep.
The statement is like basically legalese. It's meant to be boring and ignored, and it doesn't, there's like no emotion to it whatsoever. It just says like protocol for accusations changed in 2012 and then it was reversed in 2018. So he's saying it's technically allowed for me to reinstate this person, give this person a gun again, who was accused of assault and stalking and making threats and all these other things by his ex.
Right. Yeah, so this is where I think that we come back to the part that he played in the campaign, the part that former deputy Mondoyan played in the campaign, which is convincing deputies in particular, convincing department insiders and employees that Villanueva was going to be somebody that was going to go to bat for them.
Yeah.
Even in cases where you might think that perhaps he shouldn't. I mean, that is not the job of a sheriff of Los Angeles County to defend the deputies come hell or high water.
Right. But already it seems like the signature style of the Villanueva administration is going to be doing whatever it takes for his people, whoever like his guys are. And anyone who's like not in the inner circle is expendable and will just be like totally cut out. It feels like very tribal so far. It's kind of, and this is worth mentioning in the context of the sheriff's department, gang tactics.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely.
And it feels honestly like a throwback to the Baca Tanaka regime in a way that McDonald was an incompetent doofus who caused a huge amount of damage and just basically let the department run wild under his leadership. Villanueva, there's something more sinister about it,
right?
To me,
I would agree with that. I think so. Really, though, this is what, when you had all of those questions of, you know, why do the deputies want Villanueva so much as opposed to Ben Lindsay, as opposed to McDonald? This really, like, we were talking about like deputies catcalling McDonald and like boisterously cheering for Villanueva when they were at the PPOA debate. That is something that is surprising out of context, but given the context of Villanueva basically saying like the system that puts pressure on deputies to comport themselves in a specific way is flawed inherently.
It's too harsh.
I'm going to get rid of constitutional policing advisors. Yep. I'm going to reinstate people that are accused of domestic violence. Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was honestly probably the only thing McDonald did right. Is he tried to get out the list, the Brady list of sheriffs that had committed all kinds of misconduct. And he was doing it for procedural reasons. Cases were getting thrown out when these deputies were revealed to have done all these ridiculous things. But Villanueva said out loud on the campaign that he thought that was a bad idea. He would not have released that list.
And so the other component that remains to be seen, I think, is that Villanueva, when he was constantly trashing the Brady list, was saying that he knew who the actual bad actors in, not just in the leadership, but also among the deputies were. And that he would take action against them. I don't think that we've seen that to date, and I'm kind of wondering.
He might have. I mean, he fired so many people. And James Sexton, the former deputy who came on the show, said that there were lots of really bad actors at the top of the department under McDonald, former Baca people who were never held accountable. And since so many people at the top got fired, it wouldn't surprise me at all if there were like a lot of the people James Sexton was talking about were casualties of the mass layoff that happened under Villanueva. But still, we don't know. All we know is that they weren't his people.
Yeah.
What's the and one? So we're at the line. We get one shot.
Our and one this week is going to be that we finally, two sheriffs later, have our final guilty verdict returned in the last of the Lee Baca era scandal trials. This is reporting from Joel Rubin of the LA Times this week that Byron Dredd has been found guilty by a jury of lying to the FBI about his role in the beating of a visitor to a county jail. So this is, I guess, finally closure for the Baca era. I wish I could say that we have passed some sort of threshold, but as this is the sort of back end of a two-parter of pretty disgraceful conduct, I think we can credibly say that that is not the case yet.
Is the Baca case not still on some kind of appeal?
It might be, actually. So
because I know he's not like locked up. But he did get a guilty verdict.
Yes, yes.
But I think we can never count out the Baca days. In terms of just like stretching out forever in court.
That's true.
Just as a little coda, the Women's March was this week. Mm-hmm. It was Saturday. The crowds were, you know, like lots of people turned out for a march. But I think for the Women's March, the turnout was not as big as it has been in past years. What do you think? What do you think that means?
So this is kind of interesting to me because this is the third year doing it. The Women's March has, I think, gone from being what was on inaugural. Trump's actual inauguration day, a cultural touchstone.
The biggest one was in LA. I think it was like 750,000 people.
It was an absolutely massive number of people. Metro was completely non-functional.
Yep.
From all of the people. And that, I think that kind of startled them because now every time they do the Women's March, they add service, which is funny because it's never been necessary since then. But yeah, the crowds are getting smaller. I think it's interesting because a lot of people are talking about the Women's March in terms of like, are people moving on from these issues or are people actually starting to normalize the reality of like daily life in the Trump administration?
I don't think it's that.
I don't think it's that either, which is interesting because I saw that written in a number of places.
Right. I think the urgency of marching has diminished, but I think people have just sort of funneled their hopes into the Mueller investigation or into like the House investigations and things like that. And just thinking like the pressure to march is not as high as it was. And I also don't think you can discount the fact that the Women's March brand is not the healthiest that it could be.
Absolutely. There have been a lot of stories. I think that just even if it hasn't resulted in people directly wanting to distance themselves from the Women's March, that there is definitely something permeating the moment as far as what it means to actually participate in the Women's March.
Right.
But I do think that from my perspective, we just had the massive wave elections here in LA and in California in particular in November. So there are a lot of ways that I think you can look around and see that people are very active, very much not normalizing the present state of condition. I think you're dead on about the urgency of showing up and marching versus other avenues of political activity. But I think that we've definitely seen an uptick in that.
And I think you can also look at the march for the teachers. Earlier the same week, I think people were really surprised. A, it was pouring rain that day, and B, like the turnout was a lot higher than people expected, and not just teachers, people from all over the
city.
True. So I think engagement is still high on all kinds of like progressive causes in the city. It's just the Women's March specifically, does not have the urgency that it used to.
I wonder if that's it. I feel like there is potentially like this element of it where things like the strike, things like voting, where it's not just making a statement, but making a statement that is more proximal to achieving some sort of direct goal that is known and agreed upon. That might be.
It might be. I think it's probably more people listening to local news podcasts instead of national news podcast. Thank you for listening. Alyssa will be back next week with us on LA Podcast. Bye.